Welcome to Launch, where we explore the world of invention and entrepreneurship. I'm Jim DeBetti here with my co-host Ron Reardon and our producer Lee Cantor. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hello, Jim.
Good morning. Good morning. Sorry I missed last week. I know, Ron, you had a great show. How did everything go off?
Well, I guess I could say it was great because you weren't here.
But
a little hostility early on. That's what happens when you give them donuts. See their sugar levels through the roof? They misbehave.
That's right.
Yeah, Lee, I love these great donuts.
Holy donuts from your neck of the woods in Brooklyn.
Yeah, pretty close to my neck of the woods.
Just right down the road. And so it's these semi-healthy donuts, which we're all enjoying this morning.
Yeah, any donut you could eat that's, what is it, less than 200 calories with...
Yeah, 3 grams of fat.
Banana cream filling, Oreos on top.
Yep.
We have to get send these in for testing to see if they really are 200 or 2,000 calories.
Right. It's like that Seinfeld, you know, with the yogurt.
Yeah.
It was great.
All right. In the news over the last few weeks, I think we've seen a lot about all these different shows that seem to be getting a lot of TV time and a lot of press. And I wanted to talk about them today because I think that it's obviously very important for people to know what we think about these shows and, you know, if they really are beneficial to inventors.
Yeah, because inventors and inventions are really in the news and really seems to be getting a lot of traction, especially in the media.
Yeah, there's a couple of shows actually out right now. The one I've been watching over the last few weeks is called Pitchman. Ron, you've seen that one, right?
I've seen the snippets of it, yes.
Yeah, I watched one in its entirety last week. It's got Billy May, that guy who does
the infomercial.
The infomercial guy who does Oxy. I think that's his big claim to fame. And Anthony Sullivan. He's got that, I think it's like a British accent.
So that makes it exotic then. He must be the smart guy.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Right. And it's interesting. They walk around, an individual who's got a product, but they're trying to get on an infomercial.
So they follow one person around? Is that how it works?
From the one episode I've seen in full, it looks like they followed one person around for much of the show, but they had somebody else that they kind of went back to and said, right, I guess following up and seeing how they're doing. But it was interesting.
Yeah, because, when you and I were in Las Vegas last year, I think it was at Invent Bay, Billy May had a little cubicle there, and they were bringing inventor after inventor after inventor in for him to take a look at what they had to see if it was something he wanted to pitch.
Yeah, I don't think there's any shortage of potential people for the
with
show.
Products and ideas. Yeah, now, is Billy Mays, is he a real legitimate person, or is he just like the host of infomercials?
No, he's a real legitimate person. He's a pitch man. I mean, he started off in Atlantic City pitching whatever, just drawing a crowd with his voice and all like that, and eventually moved to TV with things like OxyClean.
But he never invented anything, right?
No, he's not an inventor. He just pitches other people's inventions. You know, Mighty Putty, the Hercules hook, all that kind of stuff.
I guess the old proverbial voiceover type person. I mean, his voice is recognizable, so he's got that clout.
And also his black beard and black hair.
That's true. That's true. I think there's an upcoming episode on Pitchman where his partner, Anthony Sullivan, also does a fake beard and dyes it black, and they kind of go on and look the same.
That's too much. That's funny.
But, again, these shows are really coming to light. Obviously, with the economy being what it is, a lot of people are getting laid off or worried that they're going to get laid off and, of course, start to think about can they bring a product to market.
That's true.
And then infomercial, that's the payoff on this Billy May show, that you get your product on an infomercial?
Right. And I'm not yet quite sure if it's something that they produce, or I know that they do bring the inventors around to different infomercial companies. So I would imagine that they do that, but maybe Anthony and Billy Mays, there it is, got drawn a blank there, get on and actually pitch the product on that
for them
show.
So that would be big for them to get somebody like Billy Mays to pitch their product.
Right, because, again, everybody knows him. So I have to watch a couple more episodes and get kind of caught up to speed
but
on what's
is,
going
are
on.
But infomercials, is that a good way to market your product?
Yeah, I mean, if again, the odds are very low that you will have a big success. And actually, I think it's probably much lower than getting a product sold at retail. But if you do get a hit,
it could be huge.
It could be. I mean, think of all the things that you see on TV, like the ab roller and, all the Ginsu knives back in the day. I mean, those things, those people made a lot of money.
Yeah, slices at dices,
Now, have you guys been involved in any of that?
I have not. Certainly, the infomercial world's always, it's been around obviously for decades. And it's interesting because there's a lot of companies that do it on their own and charge a lot of money. But the bigger, more reputable companies usually don't charge you upfront money. But what they do is they wind up basically owning
a portion,
a large portion.
Large
I mean,
portion.
More in the 95-ish plus
oh,
percent.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's that big of a percentage?
It's pretty huge. I remember the Smart Spin from several years ago. Mm-hmm. The inventor of that came and spoke here in Atlanta. And when he was talking to the company that was going to do the infomercial on TV and everything, they gave him several options. They said, well, if you just bring your patent to us, we'll give you this much money. If you'll pay for the filming of the infomercial, we'll give you more. And then if you split the cost of the advertising on cable and everything right. like that, we'll give you even more. Well, they ended up spending $5 million on advertising.
Wow.
But they sold over $200 million, okay? So they did okay.
They did all right.
But he didn't split that because he didn't have $2.5 million. But he did pay for the commercial, which mm-hmm. I think was about $50,000 to film the commercial.
You know, it's all about risk for these infomercial
sure.
companies. So if Ron were to come to me with a product and I sat down with my team and I'm the infomercial company and we say, wow, this thing looks like it, you know, based on historical other products,
sure.
we can make a lot of money with this. We may be willing to pay everything up front, but if it's a little more risky, we may say, hey, Ron, you know, if you chip in, you know, $50,000 for production and $20,000 for script write, then he's sharing in the risk.
That's right. And the information I got from the person that orchestrated all this was that the inventors received so far about $3 million.
Out of the $200
million? Yeah.
Still not bad. I mean, I guess it'd be nice to get 100 of the $200 million, but, you know, $3 million's not bad. But, you know, you think about it, if you don't really do the work, so to speak, and you can pull in, even if you pull in $300,000, that's a
right.
big payday for somebody, and you have experts producing the show and doing all that work to get it
right.
there. That's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't turn down a check for $3 million.
Yeah, but they came in with an idea, and they thought they were going to, that it was their, you know, baby, and then they're going to just give it to somebody else to basically run with.
Right. He didn't do all the heavy lifting.
Okay. Right. Well, he came up with the idea. I mean, that it seems that the idea becomes minimized.
Well, it does, because an idea is just that. It's an idea.
Right. I mean, he had a rock-solid patent on
right.
it, but he didn't have a clue as to how to get to market.
Right.
And so he was able to engage an agent, and the agent's the one that I know, that was able to connect all the dots and get it made in China and get it, you know, on TV and the whole deal.
It's all about risk. I mean, the more money you're willing to risk, the more reward.
The more you get.
But if you go to an infomercial company and want them to pay for everything and they take the risk financially, then obviously you can't expect to get much in return.
Right.
Yeah, I
that's
mean,
the reality.
I mean, the inventor's investment was, you know, he made the first prototype out of wood, and he had paid for the patent.
And he paid,
you know, the money for the filming of the commercial. That was his entire investment. And then he got $3 million out of it. So it's pretty
right.
good.
Still think that's pretty good. I mean, if you don't really make a huge outlay and you can make that kind of money, I know personally I wouldn't have a problem with that. But, you know, again.
But how many people that spend the $50,000 and do that, and then the thing explodes and all they have is, you know, a garage full of widgets?
No, that
that's the risk.
And that happens, yeah.
Right.
And it happens a lot. And
it
I think
probably happens more often than the $200 million lottery winner.
That's right.
I just think, I remember there was one of the infomercial companies had mentioned to me that, and here are the numbers, if they look at, I mean, they obviously look at thousands of things
sure.
a year. They pick about 30 to 35 items to run on TV. They'll test them and then actually run them at different times of the day and night. And of those 35, maybe 6 to 10 will do marginally okay.
Right.
And of those 6 to 10, only 1 to 3 will actually really make them any good money. So,
yeah.
So,
those are the numbers.
1 out of a 1,000.
Yeah, and probably worse than that. I mean, I guess they get probably tens of thousands of ideas. I mean, every day they're getting solicited.
Right, somebody with an idea.
And, you know, one of the previous guests on this show, John Strobel with the Picture Placer,
right.
They've finished filming the infomercial that he's going to have up in Chattanooga. And I don't know, you know, where it's going to be shown or anything like that, but I have seen it, and it looks pretty cool.
Now, is that something that you would recommend if a person is going to go the infomercial route? Should they be, you know, getting their flip video and filming this themselves, or is it better for them to go to a professional that does this every day?
Yeah, you can't do things like that on your own. To be on TV, you got to have, you know, high quality production. It's got to look professional, and it can't be cheesy. It's got to be something that, hey, I'm watching, I'm going to want to buy it.
Right. It's just got to be cheesy enough for an infomercial.
Exactly.
It's that fine line between cheesy that's terrible and cheesy enough for an infomercial.
Yeah. And there's more. And wait.
Wait.
And
that's not all.
And we'll double the offer.
Right. But people like that. It It works. It still works. It worked 30 years ago.
Not even 30. It worked 50, you know, in radio time they were doing those kind of commercials.
It's really the old, you know, buyer beware. I think if people know the actual risks, then they would think twice about how to spend their money and finding the right people to do it. So, again, it's just like any other part of this business. It's a risky business.
Yeah.
But it's exciting that there's a lot of these shows popping up. Now, you mentioned The Pitchman. And what are some of the other ones?
Well, I mean, we have The Shark Tank, which I think is an English TV show. It's based on a show in England,
right?
That they've kind of recreated the concept. And
what does Shark Man mean? Is that
the Shark Tank?
Shark Tank.
What is that?
And that's where you're going to make a pitch to VCs.
Okay,
and they're going to have about three or five VCs, and you get up and give your elevator speech and everything of here's you know what I've got, and here's how much money I need, and here's how we've done so far, and here's what we're going to do with the money, and then they sit there and pepper you with questions. It's still, you know, in the they're still gathering. Candidates to go to on the show and everything right now.
I think if you put on BBC, it's on. I've seen it on BBC.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, okay. So that's why.
So it's moving to the United States because I think it's out of Los Angeles is where this is going to be done.
Yeah, I think it's Mark Burnett Productions who's actively soliciting people to pitch, so to speak.
So right now, and then there's other shows right now that they're looking for candidates, right?
Yeah, there's another show I believe is going to be called Moms, Inc., and that's a Kelly Ripa production, and it's going to be on TLC, I believe, this fall. The details are just kind of emerging, right. But this is the story of or basically chronicling mom inventors. I don't know anything more than that, but having all the casting calls in various cities this month, or in June, rather. So
I guess if you Google Kelly Ripa or Moms, Inc., you should be able to find something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing it all over the internet, and they're actively marketing it. But I think, you know, it says something about the times that we're in now where more and more people and bigger name celebrities are getting involved in this business.
Yeah, because, you know, statistically, a very small percentage of the inventors and the patents at the patent office come from females, but that is increasing at a pretty good clip right now.
Right. I would think that that's a good market to be in because you have all these moms that a lot of them worked, you know, so their career type mentality, you know, they went to college, they're educated, they were going to work, and then they have a kid, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're at home and they realize, you know, I got some time. You know, why don't I poke around and do something?
Yeah, because, you know, one of the most recent issues of Inventor's Digest showed Joan London, okay, of TV fame. And she had invented a little device that attaches to your wrist and attaches to the wrist of your 2-year-old that, you know, there's a little string in between. That so that the child doesn't go running off, which is every parent's worst nightmare when you're in a mall or something like that. You just turn around and your kid's gone.
And that product actually is a reinvention of another invention. I've seen those
like those
leashes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is a little bit more refined and
yes, it is.
A little more convenient. I haven't seen it yet, but from what I read in the...
You can actually control, you know, whether the kid's 2 feet away, 4 feet away, 8 feet away. You know, so it's got some pizzazz to it.
Yeah, the other ones were like 20 feet long. I mean, what's the point if your kid goes in a parking lot and he runs in the middle of the parking lot?
Well, I guess the next evolution will be like those shock collars, right?
Yeah,
one they get a certain thing, they just like fall to the ground and you can go pick them up and bring them back.
Tasers work too,
but what's interesting is you know the women that are inventing it's not necessarily just stuff for kids and babies and stuff like that. I don't know if you've ever seen the invisible line pads, you know, that you have in presentations and everything.
Right.
They actually, instead of it being white, there's these little bitty lines that you can't see when you're about 10 feet away, but allows people to actually write in a straight line when they're putting stuff up there. Two women invented that, and I think they're probably in their 50s when they invented it, and it sold tons,
No, that's a great idea because the person who's writing on it could see it, but when you're far away, you can't see it. That's brilliant.
Right. I mean, it's just like, how simple is that? They have made a mint off of that.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Well, that's why I always love simple products. I always like them. If somebody can understand it in just a couple of seconds, the way you explained it, that's gold, I mean, for me. And those are the things I always love looking at.
But, yeah, flip charts. I couldn't remember the word flip chart a while ago, but, yeah, it's a little lines on flip charts.
Now, is this something, like, if you have an idea, at a beginning stage, is this something you can be approaching these infomercial companies or these TV shows and say, hey, I'm a candidate for this kind of stuff?
Yeah, like for this Moms, Inc. show, like a few of the other shows, they have casting calls. Just think of American Idol. You go, 1,000 or 5,000 people, whatever, line up in the streets. They wait to get their shot in front of a couple of judges, and then they refine it down to the finalists that get on the show.
Yeah, and I was reading the contract for the one that you mentioned before on Shark Tank and everything, and I think it's pretty much common with all these shows. They're looking for somebody that's got some enthusiasm and some energy and a little bit photogenic.
Yeah, because it's TV. I mean,
it's entertainment. Okay?
The best idea, if the right person isn't behind it, they might pass because you're not, you know, jumping up and down enough.
I mean, several years ago, we had American Inventor doing casting calls and everything. And we had some inventors that made the cut here in Atlanta that actually went, but they didn't make the final cut. And they came back with a conclusion, you know, what they were looking for was they didn't care anything about the invention. They were looking for inventors that were very entertaining.
Right.
And they had some characters on that show. I remember watching it a few times and seeing some of these people, and they're crying and they're yelling and they're kind of getting real animated, and that's fun to watch. You don't want someone just saying, "I've got this product. Here's what it does."
Right, but it's interesting because the inventor who's pitching themselves to these shows, in their mind, they're thinking they want the best product that sells the most.
Wrong.
But in actuality, the TV show—it's a TV show because they want drama and they want emotion. They want all those things that make it interesting to watch.
Yeah, it's a combination. I have looked at those contracts too. They certainly put their hand in the pie there, so to speak. The show will make money from your inventions, at least from what I've seen. I can't say that for certain, but so yeah, I think it's a combination. They want to have something that can actually succeed, but then again, it is TV. So
and anybody getting ready to go to one of those shows needs to read those contracts very carefully. I've just looked at one recently for a show that I won't mention. And I had to laugh at some of the words in there because it would have things like in perpetuity throughout the universe. I'm like, throughout the universe?
Right. So okay. If you're bringing your product to Jupiter, they still get a piece of
that
it.
That just
right?
sounds, that's code, for, away. That's code for we own you in some way, in some other language. I don't know what it means, but that's not a good, when you can't understand it, it can't be good for you. Let's put it that way. But Ron's right. You have to really be very, very careful because if you sign your rights away or life away, so to speak, and let's say the product doesn't do well or it doesn't go anywhere. Do you have any recourse? Can you get back your rights to distribute your product
without retail? Them, even though...
Right.
Yeah, because, I mean, the language I saw said, you know, that you're signing away not only your rights, but, you know, your spouse, your children, your grandchildren, your dog, you know, everything.
Anybody else connected to this.
Right.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It'll be exciting to see how this show does. None of these shows have... had any real life, and I wonder why they don't succeed.
Well, I just think television's difficult. I mean, look at American Idol is still around, but there's been a million, copycats of that just hasn't been able to stick, so it's hard to really get the right combination of judges. You know, that's an important component of it, real compelling guests. And then if they had a product or an inventor that, you know, hit a huge home run, I'm sure that would help.
Yeah, I think it's the old first-to-market, first concept. I mean, when American Idol came out, it was new, right?
Yeah.
And everybody now copies that, you know, Dancing with the Stars and all these
other
shows.
Right, but remember, there was, what was that? There was a show with Ed McMahon that was before the Star Search.
Star Search, yeah.
Right. Star Search, yeah.
And, you know, that was a similar show to American Idol.
Right, so, but I mean, American Idol, you know, glitzed it up and, you know.
Right, they just took a spin on, you know, a talent competition, basically, and then they got... good judges. I mean, the judges to me are critical. I mean, if Simon Cowell wasn't part of that show would be gone.
True.
Yeah, being obnoxious definitely is fun to watch.
People like to see what's he going to say next. You know, what crazy things is he going to say?
Yeah,
I don't know if you've seen that video that's been viewed over 55 million times from Britain's Got Talent, where this lady that's about 47 years old comes out to sing, and it's been the end of a long day, and the judges are tired, and she comes out. And they're just like, one more, you know. And then she starts to sing, and it blows everybody away.
Right. It's that surprise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that. My wife showed it to me. She actually emailed the clip, and I'm like, I don't want to watch this. How good could she be? And yeah, she's so unassuming. It's
I've seen it. She looks like a librarian, like somebody you would never think could belt. And then she sings, and you're like, you almost have to look away to not look at her sing because you can't connect her making that sound.
Yeah,
because
she's never been married, never been kissed, lives alone with her cat Pebbles, but she's got a voice like you wouldn't believe.
Right.
Well, hopefully you want people like that.
But that's the drama too. I mean, you want that surprise and the drama, and maybe they just haven't hit upon that right combination yet.
Yeah, and of course Simon on that clip sits there and says, I knew when you came out we were going to have something spectacular, and everybody's like, oh yeah, right, Simon.
You know, if you listen to, we watch as a family American Idol, and he says, like, he tells each person they're going to win so that later on he can say, yeah, I knew they were going to win. You know? Like, so right, well, there'll be a clip of him saying, I told you.
That. Yeah, I guess if he says that at some point to everybody,
right.
Then they'll just pull those clips up and go, like, yeah, see, I was right.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah, so I think the whole big takeaway with all these shows are that, again, you know, you have to understand what you're getting into. It is TV. You do have to have a good personality. You can't be shy. I mean, if you're going to go to a casting call, right. You got to show up. You got to be excited, enthusiastic, and actually have, a decent idea. But again, reading those contracts, making sure that you understand
what you're getting into is critical.
Yeah, because most of the contracts, they own, you know, your invention completely. You know, and whatever money they give you, like if they give you $1 million, then that's it. Okay. And they own your image. They own everything.
Right.
So they really need to read that contract.
And to understand, are you willing to do that?
Yeah. You know? And especially what's interesting is the most restrictive part of the contract is always on the last page. So a lot of people will read through this multi-page contract and they start getting tired and they just kind of, you know, go and sign it at the back and they just really didn't read those last couple paragraphs where everything's gone. You know?
Well, you know what? Even if you don't do well or you don't win the show, I think the smart people parlay their TV time, you know, like with people with Idol. You know, you finish eighth, but they're still making records or they're acting or they're on Broadway.
True.
I think if you're smart, you can say,
hey,
you can own my invention. I'm going to go out and be a TV star or something.
Right.
So, I mean, it's all what you make of it. But, again, it's exciting to see in our world, Ron, I'm sure you agree, that there's so much action and so much excitement, and we love it.
Yeah, and especially when you look at the tremendous industries that exist today because of individual inventors, it's pretty incredible that one person, you know, with an idea can create an entire industry.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, here in Atlanta, you know, we've got Sarah Bakely with Spanx.
Right.
I mean, I always kiddingly say was pantyhose without feet.
Right.
It's a multi-million dollar industry. One person. I mean, she was selling fax machines door to door, okay?
Right.
And now she's the head of this huge industry. But, you know, you have Home Depot started by two guys. You got the Waffle House started by two guys.
Right.
You got Chick-fil-A started by one person. You got Ted Turner and everything that came from him. One individual can create tremendous industries.
Right. You got Ron Reardon from Pats and Moore. This huge
one
person can do it.
Right.
Hey, you know, before we finish up today, Ron, you brought in this cool box cutter, if I can call it that, called from a company called Clever Innovations. Tell me more about this.
Yeah, I just came back from up in Michigan to speak into an inventors club up there on behalf of the United Inventors Association, and the president of the club. Just had a milestone. He sold 2 million of this little plastic device. And it's what's really interesting is that TSA actually allows this box cutter on airlines.
Right. Is there, like, what's the need of bringing any type of box cutter on an airplane?
Well,
like, are there boxes the peanuts?
No. I don't know.
My son. Okay.
Hurt someone?
Okay, yeah.
Who would do that?
I know. My son is a geologist. Okay.
Yes.
And he uses box cutters in his job. Don't ask me what, but he does, okay? And so because the traditional box cutters are no longer allowed because they're a weapon, every time he goes to another city, like the Little Rock, he has to go to a store
and
buy box cutters.
Right.
And then he has to toss them when he gets on the airplane to come back. Okay,
right.
So that's just part of the job now.
Right.
And this particular box cutter, because of the way it's designed here by cleverinnovations.net, is that TSA has looked at it and they said this can't be turned into a weapon, and yet it still operates as a box cutter, and so it's allowed on airplanes through security.
Pretty comfortable to hold, too. It's not
just
like
it feels good in your hand.
Right. It feels good when you want to chop a box up. It's got a nice feeling, too. But, no, I mean, this is definitely a handy thing because I usually grab, like, scissors or
my key. When I open the donuts, I had my key.
Keys
and I'm battling it.
Or I try to, like, punch it. You know, karate chop the box. That never works. But, yeah, this is a smart little tool. I think this is something I'd buy if I saw this as an impulse item in a store. I'd pick it up.
Yeah. Sure.
And, I talked to Orville Crane, who's the inventor of this and the president of the club up there in Muskegon. And he has been through a lot of failures, okay, before he came up with this, which has been, you sell 2 million of anything. That's a tremendous success, you know. So I think that's usually the pattern, is a lot of inventors will fail, and then succeed. I mean, it's a traditional story of Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
I mean, he lost every election he was in except one.
Okay. One.
And that's all you need. You're right.
Now, when you're saying fail, are you saying that he failed at attempting to build this device, or he failed and he tried other devices? What's typically the path? Like,
he started a lot of companies, okay? Mm-hmm. And so he learned what not to do, which is worth a lot of money.
Sure.
Knowing what not to do before he finally came up with this particular device. And it's done very, very well. It's now in its third generation of design. What we're holding right now is just, I think, the second generation. The first one wasn't quite as ergonomic, didn't have such a good feel. Mm-hmm. And the version that they're under production right now actually has a pop-in blade where you can actually...
It's replaceable.
Once the blade, you know, gets dull, you can get another blade in there.
Right.
Well, you know what happens a lot? A lot of inventors, or many inventors, are serial inventors, and they will call me, for example, and say, I've got 20 ideas, I've got 30 ideas, and what I tell them to do is I say, listen, you can't develop 30 things at the same time.
Right.
Let's narrow it down to just one or two.
Do you help them narrow it down?
Yeah, I have to, because sometimes they just... They come up with ideas constantly, but they may not be practical, or maybe they're too difficult to create. And, of course, it costs money to go through the process. So I tell them, listen, let's focus in on one thing, and let's go through the process. And once they learn it the right way one time, then they can take their chances and do it on their own.
It's easier the second and third time.
Once you know how to do it right the first time.
Now, how quickly can you, if somebody does have that folder they've had in their drawer for 10 years where they've accumulated all these great ideas, can you just go through there and kind of bang out, oh, that's a winner, no, that has a shot, or how deeply do you have to kind of dig to decide if something's viable or not?
Well, I mean, obviously, the first step is I usually will send those people to Ron and say, listen, first you got to make sure that you're not copying somebody else's idea, because a lot of times people just come up with ideas and write them down, not knowing
that they already exist.
They'll do a quick Google search or something, and I say, listen, if you're going to spend money on this, you know, spend a few bucks to find out if it's really not patented already. And then once they do that, I could either do a formal product evaluation, but I usually just can look at something and sometimes just categorize and say, listen, okay, well, if you come to me with a VCR, you know what? I don't think that's something we want to work on. But if somebody's got something unique like
simple,
this box cutter,
simple,
sometimes you just see stuff based on my discussions with buyers and following the retail markets, what might be a potential.
Where there might be a hole that'll fit right in there. That's something that's got a shot.
So, I mean, certainly my opinion is not the end-all opinion. It's what retail buyers think and what consumers think. But I think we have a pretty good handle on what things likely would not
work. Or have a chance, or maybe not have as good of a chance.
Right. So, but it's still a tricky thing to try to pick. It's like kind of trying to pick the stocks in the stock market.
There's no guarantee, obviously.
Right. So we do our best.
No, it's really difficult to figure out what's going to sell, because the things like, you know, the Cabbage Patch doll, really ugly doll, tremendous success.
Right.
The Rubik's Cube violated every rule of what a toy should be like.
I turned all those ideas down when they came to me.
Pass.
So it's really difficult to know what will sell.
Right. The marketplace has to decide, ultimately.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also pushed aside, like, the iPod, a few of these little...
Never catch on. Apple.
I just didn't think it would work. I didn't think it would work, but... It's funny, a lot of people, I love the enthusiasm, though. So many people have so many great ideas. And again, I always say this, the simple things are the ones that I always am more interested in.
Right.
Like this.
Yeah, something that's small, made out of plastic or an inexpensive material, that's got a lot, in my mind, a lot better shot at being successful than something that's big and huge and complicated with wires.
And
I mean, that's pretty tough.
Right.
And when you get into lots of parts, you get into, UL approvals and, when there's electrical, there's moving parts, things have to be, tested. When you have a plastic part with a razor blade, I mean, granted, there's a design component to it, but it's a mold. It's inexpensive, relatively speaking. Easy to mass produce, inexpensive.
It solves a common problem.
And somebody can pick it up and within 5 seconds.
And understand, I get how it works. Right. It doesn't need a manual.
No, there's no manual that comes with this. People can pick it up and figure out how to open up a box.
Exactly. So good stuff, guys.
Yeah, I think it's been excellent. And this has been another installment of Launch with Jim DeBetta, Lee Cantor, and Ron Reardon.